So hopefully in the future, I mean, this is obviously our pilot episode. This is a soft launch, and none of us really know what we're doing, but
It's a
hopefully
soft, by the way, launch.
soft by the way launch. Hopefully in the future, I'm hoping to get an audio mixer. We can get real microphones so it doesn't sound like I'm, broadcasting from an, airplane bathroom or something. But I do want to find a way that we can like work in audio, because like we just need to get like other audio sources. I want to get a soundboard with a reggaeton air horn, gunshots, and a toilet flushing sound. Like I spare no expense. I mean, like it's gonna get better, folks.
It's like a morning zoo crew, but woke.
Yeah, this is the Woke Zoo Crew. I guess we didn't even mention this, but I am calling episode one the Chapo Trap House. This is episode one of Chapo's Trap House, but I'm not even wed to that name. This is a very loose format we're going with here, so the name may change, the guests may change, but what's not going to change is just awesome, incredible content.
The heat of the takes will always be piping hot.
They'll only get hotter. It's going to get better and better.
Pablo's best friend, the first edition, chapter one.
Chapter one, Digiscale and Vacuum Seals, Omuerta, the code. Live by. Live by it, live it, love it.
Peace.
Signing off, folks. Till next time.
It's our 50th episode. It's our 50th episode. You just heard from me, Will Meniker, back on our first episode. I know we've made a sort of a running joke on the show about doing better, or just the phrase "do better," but I'd like to think that this is one example of us actually doing better. You heard me say there we want to have sound effects. We want to have guests, and we want to have audio that doesn't sound like it was recorded in a toilet. And I think that we've done all of those things. We have gotten better. This will be actually, I think, the last episode in which I number them. I think when we hit 50, I don't think I need to announce to you. Except for episode 69.
Of course.
I'll probably have
obviously.
To.
Obviously. And 420 when that happens.
Yeah.
And 1488 when we're broadcasting from the Pacific Island. Garbage patch.
But I just want to say thanks to my co-hosts and thanks to the listeners for getting us to episode 50.
Yeah, man. Way to go.
Is that a golden anniversary?
Yes. That's the goal. Yeah, 75 is diamond, 50 is gold.
This is our golden anniversary, and we have some anniversary wishes from a few golden friends. Let's take a trip down memory lane.
All right, lads. It's Sam Chris from Tesco Lorry Monthly Magazine. Just want to say congratulations. You're doing a bang-up job, and keep spreading those CIA psyops.
Hey boys, it's your girl Amber, and on the joyous occasion of Chapo's 50th episode, I'm reminded of the words of philosopher Georges Bataille, who said, "I don't want your love unless you know I am repulsive, and love me even as you know it." So congratulations, you repulsive fucking dirtbags, I love you all dearly, and see only more success on your horizon. Up the Grey Wolves!
Matt, Felix, Will, and Brendan. It's Derek. I wanted to congratulate you guys at Chapo for making it to 50 episodes and to commend you, of course, on your excellent choice of guests. But seriously, guys, great job and look forward to the next 50.
Hi, Chapo. It's Libby calling from DC just to say I may not be born in the USA, but I know you guys are born to run the world. That girls run the world.
Hey, this is Virgil. Congrats on 50 episodes to Felix and Jamie and Allison. I'm glad you guys are still together even though you divorced. Here's to another great 50 episodes of Radio for Citizens.
Hey guys, it's Matt V. Brady here, wishing you all a happy 50th episode. I just thought I'd drop the funny little Aussie character I did on your show. And anyway, guys, 50 episodes, that's some great work. Keep it up. Here's to 50 more. I'm walking here.
Thanks to all our well wishers. We will continue to do better. For our 50th episode here, we've got a great interview with Matt Karp. We're going to be talking to him about his book, This Vast Southern Empire and the Civil War. Roll that interview. Let's do it. Matt Karp, baby. This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. We're here with Matt Karp. Matt, what is the Vast Southern Empire?
Explain
the title.
Fuck this. I don't want to talk about my book. Can we just talk about Caleb a little bit more? I want a little bit
love
more
that
content
boy.
On Caleb okay. saying God is dead after he read Nietzsche. And what Jeff DeCone.
Okay. Now,
AJ Soprano, Brookline, Massachusetts.
Listeners found his Bandcamp page.
Fire. Street
he's
fire.
He's become like kind of a hip-hop techno producer. Who says he's also inspired by the Torah to use his Torah as inspiration to make beats. And now I found them and I was like, initially my instinct was like, we got to play these on the show. But then I was like, we really shouldn't.
They're
like,
really sad.
It's just like, he's 18 years old.
It's bad, you know,
like,
and embarrassing.
Bad enough that his dad is like such a prick. Like,
his dad makes him clean the gutters, which he doesn't know what gutters are. It's a difficult thing for him.
The best thing about that was, I forget who it is, but somebody on Twitter when they were responding to, because there was an article in like a local newspaper, you know, local boy uses the Torah to inspire his music. And they said, that's some straight up mentaculous shit from a serious man. Like Richard Kind, like draining his cyst and working on the mentaculous. Like, that's Caleb.
Yeah. But we're not going to link to it, but you can find it.
If you guys don't subscribe, you got to get on the Grey Wolf train and listen to the last episode. These guys uncovered a real life AJ Soprano in Massachusetts.
But the name of his beats are like every one of his tracks. Like, they have names like On the Grind, Determination, like Party Beat. Like, dude,
yeah, it's like very positive Linkin Park. It's positive vibes, Linkin Park.
It's so
with
perfect.
A little bit of an Ecclesiastes edge.
just a hint of having spent 6 months as a military school fail son dropout, and yeah, then back to
like,
mass.
Like
that's so dicked up, Dad.
The beats really sound like they're made on like my first Casio keyboard.
Yeah. Like,
but you know what? His parents support him.
Yeah. Love that boy.
Support him.
They love that boy.
We support his
beautiful
parents.
He's a beautiful son.
We signal boost his dad.
I do want to get Caleb to meet Ron Fournier's kid. I think they'd have a lot to talk about.
Ron Fournier's kid is like a fucking winner, though. Like,
I know he might inspire him. He might inspire Caleb to, like, you know, get his shit together. Learn how to drive.
Ron would never, by the way, write columns.
Never.
About, like, how much he hates.
He wrote a book called Love That Boy.
Yeah, he's
he didn't
the opposite.
Write a column called Shithead Listen Up.
Yeah. He's the opposite of Jeff Jacoby. Jeff Jacoby probably loves partisan gridlock.
Yeah. No, if Jeff Jacoby was still writing those letters to Caleb columns, like this year is like the headline would be like, Caleb, like sometimes your beats are fat, but sometimes life beats me up through you.
Yeah. Caleb, your music used to make me dance, but now that you've joined ISIS, you make me cry.
I feel bad making fun of Caleb, because he would be like, put his beats on the show, be like, oh son, oh you got that mixtape, let me hear that shit, and then, you know, throw that shit on, hand me that aux cord, play 3 seconds of it and be like, ah, this shit is trash, throw this in the garbage, fam, kill yourself. Like, but it's like, you know, he's 18.
Everything like, that I did when I was 18 was fucking terrible. I think I had a WordPress where I reviewed video games that I played.
I
was a regular commentator on Aristotle's Hammer, the neoconservative blog in 2002. I was very keen on the economic reconstruction of Iraq around free market democracy.
The Bremer plan.
Yeah.
Reconstruction of Iraq? How about another kind of reconstruction, folks?
Yeah.
Segway.
I could use some of that.
No, Matt, we're here to talk to you about your book. Like I said, This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. This just came out last month from Harvard University Press.
And hell yeah. Wanna, fucking smart? Is
hell
that
yeah.
going on here?
And I just, before we get into the book itself, I want to put on my publisher's hat again and just sort of
critique the book, you know, as a physical object and product. I'm going to say
I'm going to say I believe in aesthetics. I'm like Jackie Jr. It's all about the aesthetic.
I'm going to say the cover is solid. The orange color gives it good shelf presence. However, your name should be bigger.
Yeah, I know. That was extremely disappointing.
You know, I open to the first flap where it has the flap copy. I read the flap copy. It's good. It's succinct. It's to the point, but there's no drop cap. It just looked like words starting on a page.
Okay.
Quite shabby. Then to the second flap where it has your author bio, it's just an orange blank, and it just says Matthew Karp is assistant professor of history at Princeton University. Now, there's no author photo.
Yeah.
Did Harvard University Press do this on purpose? Because if people knew what a hunk you were, they wouldn't take your writing on history seriously.
They have some like old school, like Notre Dame kind of bullshit where they don't believe in author photos. Like, you know, no name on the back of your jersey or something like
what
that.
Are they
you know, I'm just a lunch pail historian. Will. I'm not a hip hop style historian. It's not about me, Will.
This sounds like
it's about the slavery. Okay.
This sounds like creeping Sharia to me. They're against imagery of any kind. Is this a Salafist press?
They're genuinely afraid that if they put a picture of my face on there, people will start to worship it appropriately. Yeah,
they should. Yeah. Hey, as we said, beautiful man.
Eric Foner, James McPherson, they all have photos on their books. They all have photos.
Shelby Foote?
One day.
and they all kind of look like turtles.
When I get out of this college racket.
Yeah, images are haram. I know we've had jokes in the past about when we talk about someone, you should Google image search them to just clown and laugh at them. Google image search Matt Karp and then laugh at yourself, fam.
Yeah, you played yourself, yeah.
No, but to the book itself. Enough about the. Let's talk about the words.
Yeah,
words are our tool. So the title is "This Vast Southern Empire." It opens. The epigraph of the book is a quote from our good friend Karl Marx,
who You got that far.
Just to prove to everyone, I read the book.
Big ups to the old man.
It says, "In the foreign as in the domestic policy of the United States, the interests of the slaveholders served as the guiding star." That's Marx in 1861. Matt, explain that, like the title of the book, "This Vast Southern Empire." What was the Southern Empire?
Well, the Southern Empire was not as we're going to talk Civil War later. I'm aware that there are a few Civil War geeks here
in attendance.
But the Civil War, the Vast Southern Empire, the argument of the book is it's not what you might expect. This is one of these little Democrat voice reversals. It's not the Confederacy, but the United States. Give me a home improvement. In the 30 years before the Civil War, the foreign policy apparatus of the American state, you know, Will, you were talking earlier, you could call it a sort of antebellum deep state in a sense, if you think about not just the cabinet members and the presidents, but the congressional committees, the diplomatic corps.
You talk about the Navy a lot.
The Navy, exactly. Yeah. The Navy,
the creation of the American Navy.
Exactly. We're run by pro-slavery Southerners, not just guys who happen to hold slaves, you know, as if that's a thing, because most people who own slaves were also pro-slavery. But some of these guys were actually some of the most aggressive propagandists for slavery. You know, people like my boy John C. Calhoun. And Secretary of State and Abel P. Upshur. He's an obscure but should be better known figure. And these guys were not just, they weren't pikers. They were hugely powerful and they were nationalists. They believed the United States was the sort of slaveholding, the champion of slaveholding across the Atlantic world, Western Hemisphere, so on.
Just reading here, you write, by the middle of the century, Southern masters ruled over the wealthiest and most dynamic slave society the world had ever known. If slave labor had an international future, they would certainly command it. Far from isolated reactionaries crying out against the transformations of the age, pro-slavery leaders warmly embraced the global dimensions of their struggle.
Globalists.
Throughout the antebellum decades, it was through the operation of U.S. foreign policy that Southern statesmen mounted some of the most daring efforts to advance the international cause of slavery. And you sort of talk about how in our hemisphere, like the three major slaveholding empires were the United States was at the top, but also Cuba and Brazil. And it was like basically cotton, sugar, and coffee.
Yeah.
And it was like, they what are you going to do with that? I don't know what I would do without any of three of those things. But I think a point you make is, far from this idea that the antebellum South was incredibly provincial and backwards, I think you make the point that it was actually the, they were actually more globally focused because they're all of these raw materials were all for export and it depended on a global market.
Right, right. And, you know, I mean, if you think about the world of the mid-19th century, you think the leading sector of the world's leading industry, which is in some sense the heartbeat of the Industrial Revolution, and, you know, other people have argued this, the British textile industry, you know, the major source of supply was the American South, was cotton. You know, that's why Sven Becker talks about the U.S. South, Felix, you'll like this, as the sort of Saudi of the 19th century world economy, the kind of producer of the most important raw material.
Well, they're missing a few apps that make Saudi Arabia what it is today. Similar amounts of inbreeding, though.
Yeah. They well, you know, but it wasn't just King Cotton. I mean, that is I like that you bring in Cuba and Brazil, because I think the idea is that These vital agricultural staples that are the heartbeat of the consumer economy of the 19th century, you know, you can't produce them if you're not whipping people in the fields. You can't produce them efficiently. The experiments in the West Indies and so on, where Britain abolished slavery, you know, were failures, and according to the sort of global capitalist class, because they weren't able to produce exports. And so slavery was this kind of like fixed necessity for global capitalism. And I mean, that's how they saw it. I mean, I want to get into some of their wackier views, too. But I think in a weird way, in the global economy of the 1850s, it wasn't a crazy thought that this actually was a system with a future.
Another point you make is that if you know that they had an ideology that they were committed to economically and politically, and they were unsophisticated about it. And like the chief thing you said is almost counterintuitive, but like the chief goal was not the expansion of territory in which slaves could be held or people could be held in bondage or land that could be acquired. It was the protection of slave property itself anywhere in the world. Particularly the Western Hemisphere.
Totally, totally. So it's always about with Cuba. It's always like, oh, we want to seize Cuba. We want to make, you know, Cuba like 8 slave states. We want the balance of power in Congress, yada, yada, yada. That's like often how we think about this. But I think they were thinking, you know, they were thinking like globalists, and they wanted, you know, they wanted to protect the sort of, for material, but also for ideological reasons, protect the sort of security of this form of property internationally. And so, you know, various sort of efforts by Britain or, you know, by other sort of anti-slavery, you know, international forces to sort of, you know, undermine Cuban or Brazilian slavery, this, you know, Southern leaders and therefore the United States was sort of there to protect and defend or serve and protect, I guess, you know, international slavery as well as American slavery.
So like this ideology, like, you know, it's an economic system, but it depends on kind of a culture and ideology. Like, what was the slave power? Like, how would you like characterize how they viewed the world and how they viewed human
Can I give
bondage?
That's a serious question. Can I give an unserious answer?
Yes, go ahead.
I want to do a historical analogy here with the proviso that 99% of historical analogies are bullshit, right?
This is a good one.
99%, yeah. It's like usually the sort of garnish that you put on an op-ed because you're out of ideas and you know need to get paid for your 800 words. So you come up with some, you open an encyclopedia and point your finger to it. But 1% are good, the ones that are developed by Frederick Engels and myself. So this one, I do think there's a case, and this doesn't work on a lot of levels because they were globalists, because it doesn't work as political economy, but I think there's a case just culturally that the slave power, or that the kind of aggressive pro-slavery class in the antebellum republic, was kind of like the alt-right today if they were actually in power, if they were the ruling class. Because on one hand, you have these extreme fringe figures, these guys who have these utterly like insane opinions, you know, that are sort of basement dwelling dorks like George Fitzhugh, who's writing like crazy theories about how, you know, slavery is the only humane system of labor.
Yeah, it should be extended. Ideally, should it be extended to white people.
Right.
Yeah.
So slavery could be extended to white people. He's got this idea. Okay, imagine that.
Just real quick before we get too far, who was George Fitzhugh?
He was the Ricky Vaughn of the
basically.
All right.
He really was. Basically, he was a sort of pro-slavery intellectual who wrote wrote very widely and aggressively about the you know, in defense of slavery against abolitionists and so on. He's cited by you know, other, you know, important slaveholders. But anyway, so and he has they have these weird, you know, they have these weird future imaginings of a world in 1950. You know, this suits people who like alt history, where the U.S. has a republic of 100 million slaves. You know, they have this like these like almost apocalyptic from our perspective visions of the future that are really dark. They've got weird racial things like Fitzhugh was really into this idea that the arc of history bent towards the southern races, like southern white races. So like the South was sort of like the Rome and Greece of like classical antiquity, and that they were fated to sort of dominate and conquer the North for some sort of like racial reasons, like the Romans were fated to conquer the fucking
Gauls or
yeah. Franks or whatever.
Bitch ass two times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's like, you know, it would be like if you had an alt-right today that was like, you know, instead of like Saxon wrath or something, it would be like, you know, I don't know, Latin vengeance or something, you know, or whatever.
Etruscan revenge.
Well, was it one of the guys who worked on Rand Paul's campaign out of this
Southern Avenger?
Southern Avenger.
Yeah, exactly.
Southern Avenger is my favorite superhero. If you say ad hominem three times in a mirror, he shows up and warns you about fleet-footed urban types.
But like, okay, so wait, I have a few more things on this. So, there's some really sinister stuff here with these slaveholders, right? Like, not unsurprisingly, but beyond the
it
fact
would have
that
to
they
be, right?
literally owned, you know, 4 yeah. million people as chattel, but. You know, they were also into this sort of burgeoning racial science. You know, these guys were collecting skulls and measuring them and talking about doing weird experiments on like black people's lungs to sort of, you know, identify different lung capacities. It's this really dark sort of sinister edge to this stuff that is very, you know, creepy, alt-right racist. But and there's a theory, there's actually a famous theory of the pro-slavery intellectual that essentially they were David Brian Davis made this argument that they're basically loser fail sons who are intellectuals in an anti-intellectual culture, right? They're Southerners who are like reading the classics and trying to like generate these highbrow arguments for slavery, but no one gives a shit because it's the antebellum South and no one reads. So they're trying to like be really smart. They're trying to like know the anime, like these Pepe guys, to impress the sort of tough, like brawny Southern politicians, you know, who actually have never opened a book. And there's some truth to that, except it unlike the current alt-right, I think it worked because you have people like Alexander Stevens or Jefferson Davis who are like then quoting or citing these and effectively, you know, mouthing these crazy racial theories on the floor of the Senate. And these people have power.
Yeah. Well, and well, the South Carolina was founded by second sons of like Caribbean. No, seriously.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Because the Caribbean, the planters in the Caribbean, they would, you know, give their once they established their plantations, they would then hand them off to their firstborn son. And then what did the rest of these assholes do? And a lot of them packed up and settled South Carolina. That's what the crescent on the South Carolina's flag represents, is fail sonnery, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's why Ignatius J. Riley is such an all-time great character, because there a lot of modern evil stems from that kind of foul sonnery, like
yeah.
of being the only guy who's read a book in a room full of guys with 85 IQs.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of, you know, there's a lot of retelling through history with all these regimes, like, you know, the Confederacy or the Third Reich for that matter, where they were just highly advanced thinkers when really they were just moderately well-read foul sons surrounded
they're
by
they're that guy in
dopes.
Jail that we got in the letter. They're the murderer in jail.
Right.
They're the alt-right nerd in jail.
Oh, yeah, what was that again?
We got a letter from someone who does prison outreach, and one of the people
talked
to is this...
He's like, I read.
Multiple
I read.
Murderer. So, yeah. Like, somebody who should get, like, a lot of, like, credentials and respect in prison for the heaviness of their crime, but, like, none of the gangs will hang out with him. Like, the AB, even though he's, like, he fetishizes his, you know...
Germanic heritage.
Bavarian rat.
The AB is like, fuck, get the fuck out of here, nerd. Yeah. You know, we want to lift weights.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing about... So these guys, like, you have this kind of... I mean, to go inappropriately make more contemporary analogies, like, so you have... Yeah, you got the Ricky Vaughn. I think George Fitzhugh's right. I think James D.B. DeBow, though, who is, like, the publisher of DeBow's Review, which is, like, the Breitbart, essentially, yeah, of the sort of Southern pro-slavery intellectual class.
Did he also die in a diaper?
Yeah, not after, sure on that. After he died, there was probably like a post-Reconstruction movement that it would have been like, he would have hated this. Yeah. he would have hated the Klan.
James D.V. DeVoe.
There was also a theory that like he was killed by like a blow dart shot by William Lloyd Garrison.
Yeah, he was actually the director of the U.S. Census. I mean, like, this guy, like, literally, who's like an insane autodidactic, you know, creep, who is appointed by, you know, essentially via his buddy Jefferson Davis as Secretary of War in the Pierce administration to be like the superintendent of the census, and then so unsurprisingly he develops all these like crazy tables about to prove, you know, racial inferiority, because these guys love math, they love arithmetic, you know.
Thing they have in common with the most annoying assholes of today. I want to get into more about like what is in like the 19th century version of like the highbrow intellectual argument for like why slavery is both just and moral.
Well, right. I mean, the thing is, well, I mean, they make a number of arguments, but the one that in my book that I think actually has received less attention, because sometimes people, you know, talk about the sort of paternalist argument, and later people wanted to find an anti-capitalist argument in it, and you can find it if you look hard enough, but it's obviously a bad anti-capitalist argument. Instead of, you know, preventing revolution a revolution against the sort of bourgeois class by proletarian revolution, it's by proletarian enslavement. But the most interesting pro-slavery argument I think that I found that is in league with some of this alt-right stuff today is, you know, when they talk about race realism, you know, it's this idea that like there are these truths that people are too afraid based on like liberal sentimentality to face. That there's this sort of like the dark reality of the world in the 1850s is, okay, you soft-headed, like muddle-brained Northern abolitionists who are sentimentalists, who are like weak, who are, you know, who, you know, essentially lack, you know, they lack masculinity, but they also lack a sort of steely will to confront the hard realities of the market, which basically demands enslaved labor.
Yeah,
and not just exploitation, but like racially, and then also the laws of science, like through all these like kooky experiments, they think are sort of ordained by God, but also by just like hard science, hard laws of economics. And anyone who sort of mushily tries to wriggle out of this, you know, is somebody like Louisa McCord. One of the most interesting characters in the book is sort of the Ann Coulter of the antebellum South, Louisa McCord, who had all sorts of, you know, she was constantly comparing black people's brains to invertebrate shellfish. And, you know, she was, you know, I don't think it's crazy to say she was an evil woman, but incredibly smart and in her weird way, and very aggressive. And it was all about, you know, her most powerful essays were about this idea that like you have to face the facts, and like only we have possession of the facts because you're too sentimental to face them.
Well, I mean, I know a lot of Northerners probably think of the antebellum South and just think, oh, what a bunch of misogynists. But here was a woman, you know, she publishing and writing and just, you know, being an intellectual.
Her voice was amplified.
I can think slavery was a horrible crime and also think it's cool that a woman rose head high. Both can be true.
Both can be true. Well, I think it's funny because we think of these alt-right guys now and like their embrace of, you know, European identity, solidarity, but like wasn't one of the leading kind of kooky edges of pro-slavery thinking, and it's interesting to wonder how far it would have gone if the war hadn't happened when it did, the realization for a lot of these guys that like white Northerners were a different race.
It's like
these are racially inferior, but like these other white people are also inferior.
Well, during the Civil War,
yeah,
you mean like this idea of like Yankee, you know, inferiority to like sort of. I mean, this was
like,
Fitzhugh was going in that
about,
direction.
Like how well they came from we come from Norman stock,
right.
And they're like pasty, Anglo, and they're like clearly an
Gallic
inferior.
Fury. Exactly. Yeah. Right, we are the sort of Latinate races, and they are the sort of crude, you know, clodhoppers. Yeah. Of the sort of northern forests who, you know, can't compete with us.
Well, let's not forget how many Irish people were pressed into service in the Union Army. And we all know about them.
Yeah.
We don't want you. I mean, I guess we're going to go there.
Speaking of
the degenerate races.
That's actually why Irish Americans are allowed to be racist today, is because of how many of them fought.
We
for
fought
the
for
North.
Your fucking freedom.
Yeah,
I get to say that word.
That's why Mark Wahlberg is half Irish. That's why he got off like blinding.
That's why he got to beat that Vietnamese guy.
Because they were like, "Well, you have like a racial credit because of the Civil
and
War."
I'll tell you right now, if I'd been there at Ford's Theater, Lincoln wouldn't have died. I would have done a roundhouse kick, knocked him right out of the fucking box.
Can we talk about John C. Calhoun? He's a figure that comes up quite a
bitch.
Bit. Yeah, he's one of the big.
I kind of think of him as like the worst figure in American political history. Like,
yeah,
like just genuine, like one of the worst influences we've ever had.
Like, yeah. It's hard to look at a picture of John C. Calhoun with those like haunted hollow eyes.
Yeah.
Don't give me your fucking Manson lamps. Just fucking stop.
You know, evil. He looks evil, fucking evil.
Yeah. Okay, explain though. Who was he and why was he important?
Oh, so John C. Calhoun is a
John C. Word Calhoun.
John C. Calhoun was a South Carolina planter who initially sort of was a nationalist in the 1820s, and then he sort of in the nullification crisis. If we're going to do like a history lesson here, he became a leading defender of slavery and South Carolina's low tariff. And then he kind of gets stereotyped in a way. He's sort of seen as a sort of go-to pro-slavery Southerner. And we think of him as a sort of ultimate sectionalist who sort of prefigured the Confederacy and Southern separatism. I mean, I guess my thing in the book is that he was also U.S. Secretary of State, and he was also the U.S. Secretary of State who brought in the Republic of Texas, the Lone Star State, which is an independent slaveholding republic. And Calhoun did that not in order to strengthen the Confederacy, but in order to expand this vast Southern empire, which was the United States. I don't think this idea that he was some historians would be like, he's a nationalist who then became this separatist and gave up on the United States. I think in a way he always sustained this belief that the Southern ruling class should be the national ruling class. And that's why he's an important figure.
Yeah, because one thing you note in the book, and I think is very important, is the degree to which states' rights rhetoric and the Jeffersonian fetish for, you know, small government and skepticism of federal power was really just instrumental. It was just it was useful when it was in the interests of slavery. But like, yeah, like expansionist territorial
right,
expansion,
right, yeah.
Military expansion.
That's
like they were fine with that if they felt like it was serving the ends. Like you have the chapter about the expansion of the Navy,
right?
Like what they wanted, like, and it was largely driven by these slaveholders who claimed to hold the mantle of the Jeffersonian, like, you know, tradition.
Small government, laissez faire.
They wanted a massive increase in the Navy in a way that like threw in the face of that entire tradition. They completely threw it out of the.
And in some ways, like the soul of the book is Jeff Davis, who's like the ultimate I wrote a book whose soul is Jefferson Davis. That's sorry, I hate myself. but in some ways he was the Secretary of War under Pierce in the 50s, and you know, he did the same thing for the Army in a sense that like that Upshur and some of these other Southerners had done for the Navy in the 40s, or he attempted to, you know, the largest peacetime increase in the antebellum Army. I mean, it was still a tiny pipsqueak army, but he was modernizing it. He actually had people go to Europe to sort of study the Prussians. He wanted a Prussian style, you know, staff organization. He had people go to Algeria. He was always comparing westward development of the U.S. to like the French in Algeria on the model of like French colonialism. You know, he was very upfront about the sort of racial and the sort of racial hierarchy of empire that should be sustained by a strong, powerful U.S. state.
Who is the biggest incel among the
Do you want to give me my you want to do my little Volcel incel theory?
Yeah,
the
because
Civil War.
That as we've discovered, and it happens over and over again, the Volcel incel battle is the battle for the soul of humanity. It's been going on since the dawn of time.
Right,
the forces of Volcel are the forces of good. Okay. Incels the forces of evil.
So you may have seen the film Lincoln. I think you do because
we talked about it last week.
We were going to do how many podcasts about the film Lincoln?
Yeah.
But so at the end, and one of the cornier touches in that movie is like at the end, like Tommy Lee Jones is kind of like he's reading the 13th Amendment aloud, like sort of with his housekeeper, who is his, you know, his mistress, in effect. Lydia Smith is the character. He lived with his black housekeeper for 20 years and they had a romantic relationship. But what you don't know about Thaddeus Stevens is for the previous 56 years of his life, he was straight up Volsel. He did not. There is even a letter. There's a letter. Let me find this thing. I have this letter where he writes about how he has never seen. Hold on. We can find this. Where is it? All right, we can. It's okay to be.
Yeah,
able,
yeah, yeah. We can add this
yeah,
up.
Yeah.
Okay. N-word. He says. Where is it?
Women are not human.
I pretend. So he's when he was like in Pennsylvania politics in the 30s, he's accused of being of like fornication by sort of fathering a child out of wedlock. And he writes to his friend, "So far from being a seducer, I vow to God that I have never learned, except by description, the meaning of the maidenhead." the meaning of maidenhead. So he's straight up. I mean, although I guess obviously he's read some erotic stories or something. I don't know.
Like he's never seen. He's never
Yo, what a shock. Another man who can't find the G-spot. You know what I'm talking about, ladies? She knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, he may have listened to, you know, the 19th century Rich Piana and had all these ideas about how to the 39 orgasm.
Speedbag that shit.
Yeah. After during Reconstruction, like that's when Dan Quinn time traveler happened, and Dan like used the stevia time machine to go back and be like, "Oh my God, you basically deserve to know the secrets of the violin." John C. Calhoun, listen up. I would basically make you a millionaire by letting you throw punches on me and proving that the plantation system was doomed, homeboy, and all the smoking tobacco crop dusted with stevia, man.
Just 30 hits straight in a row, back to back.
In the motherfucking weed smoking Olympics, oh my God, I would beat the best weed smoker in the CSA. Listen up, homeboy. You don't know where the maidenhead is? All right, so you put two fingers on and around the maidenhead. You play the clit like a swizzle stick flute that it is, and you are in triple digit orgasms with your housekeeper, homeboy.
Okay, but
I'm imagining Dan Quinn incident at Owl Creek Bridge where they're about to hang him, but he just pulls up his shirt and he's just like, "Yo, you see that, homie?" And they're like, "Respect."
Dan Quinn was basically John
etched.
Brown. Yeah. He was John Brown. Like, he's the same thing.
Yeah. The etched abolitionist. So Stevens basically Volsel for the first 56 years of his life. We do know that there is an anecdote of a woman who did have several flirtations, and at one point a woman. One of his biographers talks about a woman sort of proposing that he like buy her a diamond ring or something like that, and she gets a little edgy, and he just like ghosts on her and never sees
total
her again. So I think it's complete
Volsel. He's got to keep his essence. He's got to keep his essence for the fight.
Nah, dude, he's a fuck boy, dude. I've read Medium posts about guys like this.
Okay, so that's the North. This is you know, arguably the second most important Northerner during the Civil War and the most important after the Civil War. So the vice president of the Confederacy, a little dude named Alexander Hamilton Stevens, was a Georgian, pro-slavery to the core, actually an incredibly creepy guy. He was about 5'7", 75 pounds. Nobody believes this, but he was 75 pounds, according to his biographers.
Manlet.
Total manlet.
Yeah. His bones were like visible through his translucent skin.
Like,
there is no end of antebellum letters and print journalism comparing him to a corpse and a zombie. But he is, you know, an incredibly powerful pro-slavery politician in Georgia. He becomes VP of the Confederacy. Absolute incel. All of his documents, all of his, at no point has he ever been recorded to have any contact with a woman, and no woman would surely have one had any contact with him.
Of course not. Yeah, he was a
man, I should say.
He was a deep sea creature, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, no, he was an absolute ghoul.
Wow, what a shock. Yep.
So Volsel versus incel, and, you know, guess who wins?
Fucking Volsel, baby.
Volsel, it is better to have access to and deny.
Because it shows its inner strength. Incel creates bitterness. It creates anger that then overtakes your soul.
This is what Star Wars is about.
Yes.
basically,
Anakin Star Wars was too.
Yeah.
back to the educational part of this interview. You mentioned back to Stevens. Now Matt made reference to this earlier
Which one?
In the week. Thaddeus.
Okay,
the good Stevens.
The good one. The Vol Cell.
The one with
Stevens.
The V.
Yeah.
The one with a V.
Ooh.
they sort of make reference to this in Lincoln, but could you talk more about what his plan was for how to handle Reconstruction, about how to literally relocate the entire planter class?
I literally took a photo of this speech. It's one of my favorite speeches here that I, because I heard Matt, you were talking about this last week. In September of 65, he lays out his vision of confiscation of Southern estates, where he wants basically... brand the leading planters of the South as traitors and deprive them of their property. And, actually, he didn't want to give all of it to former slaves. It was like 20% was going to go to slaves. The rest of it was going to be like confiscated by the government and sold and shit like that. But he gives this amazing speech where he basically says, if the South is ever to be made a safe republic, let her lands be cultivated by the toil of the owners or the free labor of intelligent citizens. This must be done even though it drive her nobility into exile.
Fuck yeah.
If they go, all the better. It is far easier and more beneficial to exile 70,000 proud, bloated, and defiant rebels than the...
Great bitches.
Then to expatriate 4 million of laborers, natives to the soil and loyal to the government, and
hell
that's
yeah.
what he's talking about
Fuck
the
yes.
Enslaved class.
Yeah. So, I mean, where would he have sent them?
I don't know. This is beyond.
I mean, I like to imagine they just dump them in the ocean. But if you don't want to do that, like, you could have bought like some fucking like rock from the British or somebody in the Caribbean or like in the far west. You know, the pollen, like Guam or something. Come on, you
could what is that?
Give them 40
St. Helena
acres.
Or something.
Yeah,
right?
Give them fucking. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, give Atlantic. Those assholes 40 acres and make them fucking till it.
What if you put them in a room with the freed slaves and they had to like get a compromise?
I like how Stevens rips on these guys for being bloated too. Like that's a little Dan Quinn moment. It's like, yeah.
Yo, you genetic bitch. I actually don't like it because it's lookist.
Speaking of Lucas, though, can we do a little Robert E. Lee?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because Matt was asking me the other night about Robert E. Lee and how actually tell your little Robert E. Lee story about how when you were a kid you were into Robert E. Lee and then
because I was a Civil War kid and I
one of those
one of those Civil War nerds like went to reenactments and shit real like went to my town's Civil War roundtable, which is like 60 old like a bunch of 60-year-old dudes and me. I was like 12. So I was a big fan of Civil War, obsessively studied it. I drew battle scenes and stuff, and I I prefer the North. I love the I thought they were the good guys. It was pretty clear. And the purity of their cause to me anyway at the time, like, really was one of the compelling things. I was like, yes, these are fucking good guys. And they won. Fuck you. But there's that Ron Fournier thing of wanting somebody on the other side to like think
some complexity.
Of as an honorable yeah. and a complex
want some prestige TV
and
ambiguity.
You want a little prestige TV in it. Yeah. You want an honorable opponent, somebody who's maybe a tragic figure. And I was like, Robert E. Lee, man, he didn't really like slavery. He didn't really want to leave the Union, but he felt compelled to because of his loyalty to his home state of Virginia, and that's just sad. But no, fuck that guy.
Yeah, I mean, the truth about Robert E. Lee is my take is that he's really he's actually not that special as a sort of a representative of the Northern Virginia planter who had slaves, defended slavery as a necessary evil, occasionally fetched his runaways and beat them, presided over an army that marched into Pennsylvania and kidnapped slaves.
Free
black
citizens.
But where he did distinguish himself most spectacularly was that he was extremely hot.
And
I think that's why he gets away with what he gets away with. There's no end of people showing up and being like, damn, he is the handsomest man I've ever met. Civil War, like people from Britain coming in the 1860s with his, silver fox, white beard. And, I mean, he's gorgeous.
That's the same thing. It's like the same thing why so many people respect Evan McMullen. Like, as a never Trump conservative, it's because he's hot, because people want to fuck him.
Extremely hot.
Robert E. Lee. Yeah. Okay, we've talked
Google
about
young Robert E. Lee.
Yeah. Thaddeus Stevens, played by Tommy Lee Jones in Lincoln. Robert E. Lee, played by Martin Sheen in the film Gettysburg.
Now, there is no time for that. There is no time.
Okay, all right, I'm going to take
should
this.
Should have been like Vigo or something, yeah. not beautiful
How about Bradley Cooper?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Viggo Mortensen would have been too young at the time Gettysburg came out. He was, that's when he was in Carlito's Way going, I can't piss, I can't shit, kill me, man. Sorry to take this weird digression, but okay, the film Gettysburg, right, is basically historical reenactment of the film.
I watched the shit out of that. Yeah. Thing. I saw that in the theater
the same director of that went on to do the other movie, the worst Civil War movie ever. Gods and Generals.
Talking about OGG?
Yes.
Of Gods and Generals. OGG.
Are a band of brothers and native to the soil, fighting for our liberty, famine, war, and toil. And when our rights were threatened, the cry rose near and far. Hurrah for the bunny blue flag that bears a single star. Hurrah, hurrah for solid rights, hurrah.
Texas boys, a debt of gratitude for putting on these shows.
Cravat, any man can't handle guitar or fiddle, ain't fit to carry mustard.
The kind will be as just, but now in northern treachery attempts our rights to mar. We hoist on high the bonny blue flag that bears a single star. Hurrah, hurrah, for southern rights, hurrah, hurrah, for the bonny blue flag that bears a single star. Here's to our Confederacy, strong we are and brave. Like patriots of old, we'll fight our heritage to save. And rather than submit to shame, to die we would prefer. So cheer for the bonny blue flag that bears a single star.
Hurrah, hurrah, for southern rights, hurrah. Hurrah for the bonny blue flag that bears a single star.
Say this seriously.
It is the worst film I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Top to bottom.
You can see, like, the paint of the people's beards.
And every, like, and all, like the glue and all the of their beards. Scenes, they're all, like, fat middle-aged guys, which is who does reenactments. And it's like, these guys were all, like, 95-pound, 18-year-old farm boys. And all the guys doing this fat are, like, fat, like, car salesmen. And like, their fucking buttons are bursting. They're so fucking tubby.
It's like 4.5 hours long. And it completely embraces the lost cause revisionism.
Yeah. It is explicit, which is so, like, breathtaking, because, like, Gettysburg, one of the reasons I had that little, like, nerd boner for it was, like, the scene with Jeff Daniels as Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain.
Was it Little Round Top?
One of my favorite guys from the Civil War.
What was the name of the hill that he defended?
Little Round Top.
Little Round Top, yeah.
Yeah, save the line. And he's given a speech to his dudes, and he goes, "We are not seeking loot or aggrandizement or glory. We're an army sent to set other men free." And I'm like, yes, oh my God, that's awesome.
I just wanted to bring up this about OGG, and maybe we can even edit in some of the audio, but
I know what you're going to talk about. George Allen
has a cameo
there's
in
a movie. Oh, I didn't know that. So I need to re-see this movie.
It's a 4-hour long movie. It's all terrible battle scenes.
Horrible acting.
Glued on beards.
Confederate, like straight Confederate apologia, lost cause fetishism. And then a musical number. There's a moment when all of the Confederate generals are behind the lines relaxing, and they're having a little jamboree, and it's this, like, dude, this theatrical gentleman from this 1860s theatrical gentleman in like a top coat singing the song "Hurrah, Hurrah, Southern Rights, Hurrah." And he's like,
"Maryland, my Maryland."
Yeah, no, it was just that one, sadly. Okay. But it was like, and he had, like, that very theatrical voice. It all felt very show tunes. And then there's this group of Confederate generals sitting in the front row singing along to it, and one of them is former Virginia senator and would be president if he hadn't gotten murked by Jim Webb.
Yeah, bitch.
The one good thing.
Talk
Jim
about
Webb
another alpha.
Did.
Another
yeah,
alpha.
Yeah. Jim Webb murking George Allen.
Chapo
was
hero.
Really,
yeah.
Was really
Jim
one
Webb.
Of the great political feats of the 21st
Reagan
century.
Reagan Democrat, bitch. Yeah.
But, and he's in the front row in a Confederate uniform singing.
Oh, that's
Southern
amazing.
Rice
I don't
do you think
I
grew up. That bitch grew up
in California.
California.
I know. That is so
I mean,
dark.
He didn't actually know he was being in a movie. He dressed up Like, they just knew that George Allen dressed up like a slaveholder every Sunday and filmed around him.
Yeah. I mean, this brings up another good point about how a fucking scumbag like George Allen, who's from California, can, you know, emotionally identify so much with the great lost cause of the Confederacy. But, like, Matt, as someone who is a professor of history and studies and has written about the Civil War, like, what is, like, the major misconception in contemporary Americans' understanding of the Civil War, or rather, as an addendum to that, why does this lost cause shit continue to exist?
I actually know that there are. They did a Pew did a survey in 2011 that found that 51% of the country thinks that it was if you're given a slavery or states' rights option, people go states' rights.
Okay,
so there is this misconception. You're right.
And the snappy answer to that, the smart comeback to stupid answers about states'
right
rights
to own
is
slavers.
Yeah, just say what right did they lose when they lost the Civil War?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's like the idea that it's like...
And they would say, what, to like print their own money or something?
It's, you know, it's the constitutional principle. Yeah. No, the idea that this war... I mean, the crazy thing for me overwhelmingly is it's not a historical question. It's a political question. So that's like, in a way, beyond to explain... In some ways, Lost Cause makes every bit of sense in the world in the sense that this section of the country suffered a devastating and brutalizing defeat that was, you know, in every bit earned, and in some way should have been, I think, should have been more comprehensively carried out.
Hell
but
yeah.
The fact that they're bitter about it for generations afterwards is really not that surprising. That's kind of how, you know, people react to wars. It's more shocking that, you know, a place like Germany doesn't have a kind of, you know, a larger degree of sort of like Nazi nostalgia.
You know what they love in the Germany? They love Civil War reenactments, and they love reenacting as the Confederacy.
Yeah. I mean, Europe is into that stuff. It's creepy.
They love the Confederacy.
But I think as a matter of history, I mean, it's crazy. Honestly, all you have to do is like read a newspaper, read a letter, read any primary document, because these guys did not hide talking about slavery. You know, they wanted to talk about skulls. They wanted to talk about the weirdest, grossest stuff all the time. And they every time. One of the reasons why, as a historian, I really did like it was useful and convenient and easy to study slaveholders is because every time you're looking for them to say something that is going to like clinch your argument, they'll say something that's like more whack than even you'd imagine. And they don't hide it. They're not subtle about their affirmation of this system as the centerpiece of a sort of economic and racial hierarchy.
There was an anecdote that speaks to that at the beginning of your book, and it was just so perfect reading it. I was like, oh man, he must have loved it when he found this detail. And you're talking about this Virginia jurist who became a novelist, and he wrote this futurist story. It was in he wrote it in the 1840s, but it was on in 15 years in the future when there's a civil war, you know, between the sections. And his book, the reason for the war was a tariff dispute, which you can make sense because like the last big sectional crisis had been about tariffs, you know, the nullification crisis. And he sent it to Duff Green, who was this pro-slavery political fixer and publicist and newspaper man in Washington, D.C. And
he was like a Steve Bannon, maybe.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he's like, hey, you know, what do you think of the book? And he reads the book and he goes, yeah, it's very good, but, you know, why the hell is this about fucking tariffs? It should be about slavery.
Right. It's about slavery, and it's actually about the British war on slavery, and it should be about like the danger of international anti-slavery. This is where there's that I'm doing it again. There's that globalist register to this. But the funny thing is, yeah, they never hit it. That was like a rare instance where the guy like was like, actually, it is a principled resistance to northern cupidity, you know, or whatever. It's like, no, it's about slavery. But they, as soon as the war's over, like all these guys, Alexander Stevens, Davis, they all write these like incredibly long, like self-indulgent memoirs, in which they downplay, you know, because it's like they have been forced by a political revolution followed by a war to abandon this reactionary belief. And so they literally can't own it anymore. They can't own it.
Ironically, they can't own something.
They've been owned so bad. Oh, uh-oh.
They got owned out of owning.
They were owned out of owning.
They wouldn't have been able to write those books if they'd been fucking hanged.
True. But they immediately start backpedaling. And it's really instructive to read Davis's sort of reflections after the war and virtually any speech he gave in the 1850s. Because it's like, it's night and day about this stuff. And it's so naked. It's so it is, and this is a not, I mean, the way in which people today like naively read these memoirs, or you know, this sort of would be, you know, lost cause propagandist without ever bothering to read something from like the actual period where people had slaves and, you know, trumpeted it.
I think you got two things. We've got like the lost cause, I think, at like the grassroots is based in just a lot of sort of, yeah, a sense of aggrievement and a sense of loss of entitlement and just good old fashioned racism and like a way to express one's preference for a racial hierarchy. But I think among a certain strata of more intellectual types, your Southern Avengers, you know, there is a kind of dumb, but in its own way, if you're really being obtuse about it, persuasive case that like the Confederacy was really like the last large-scale resistance to the encroaching capitalism. And now, like, we're living in the backwash of it, you know, and we're in this, like, late capitalist shit realm. And we look, and some people look back and they're like, oh, man, like, these were the people, the last real large-scale resistance to it.
Well, I mean, you had somebody like, you know, a famous historian, Marxist historian, Eugene Genovese, who is not a lost cause. Maybe by the end of his career, he become a Catholic conservative and was virtually in that camp. But even as a, you know, when he wrote, you know, The Political Economy of Slavery or whatever, you know, these like 60s books, you know, coming straight out of the Communist Party, he definitely had, I mean, in my view, what was, you know, they're actually great books, but in my view, sort of, yeah, like a wrongheaded, in a sense, a romantic nostalgia. Like these were this was the strongest force that was standing up against the Northern bourgeoisie.
Exactly.
And, you know, even though, you know, parentheses, it was, you know, populated by, you know, ghoulish sadists, but at least they were, you know, they had a chance, they had a fighting chance against this.
Yes.
And so we have to kind of embrace them or at least, you know, honor their memory or something.
Right. Yeah. 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 But that is, as we need to stipulate, that's dumb because it always requires, because obviously when the thing you live in is going to feel more real than to something you've just read about, but it really was really, really bad. Come on. It was slavery. It was bad. if you want to take something away from today's episode, everybody, it's that slavery's fucking bad. Come on.
Well, another point you make, and you sort of push back against other historians who have written about this, or Hobsbawm in particular, like you kind of take issue with this idea that were it not, if the Civil War never happened, like essentially the slave power would have petered out on its own. That there is a lot of forces like arrayed already against it in terms of like a modern capitalist economy.
Right, I mean that's a conventional interpretation, and I don't want to go too far in this, you know, kind of like weird Atlantis of like counterfactual of
they had a machine gun?
Yeah, right, exactly. What if
Chris Kyle went back in time?
I think we know what side he would have been on.
Yeah,
he's like fuck, I wouldn't have had to stand behind Lincoln to shoot him in the head. I would have been across the street.
Yeah, like you don't have to go and fantasize about a sort of 20th century South that if only an accident of history. I mean, there is something to like Hobsbawm's, you know, sort of Marxist understanding of, you know, the way in which the world economy was actually turning against these like producers of raw materials, and that they weren't going to be able to sustain the political power, the economic power that they'd accumulated up until this point. That industrial capitalism actually was bigger, badder, stronger. I mean, the North did win, you know, more able voluntarily to refrain from sexual activity. All the things that allowed the North to win the war. So the South was not. I don't want to argue that if it hadn't been for this, that you know we would have like a slaveholding power today. But that said, in the 1850s, in this moment, I do think it was a strange enough moment that the sort of hindsight view of their inevitable doom was very much contested, and they didn't see it that way. They really thought that their future was the future.
Well, I want to go back to this,
and that explains why they acted so aggressively.
Well, I want to go back to this idea that you mentioned in the beginning, where they were writing their own kind of like this very dark science fiction, but for them, not the case that a century from their present in the 1950s. America would be a society with 100 million slaves.
Yeah.
And then you said that they were also flirting with the idea that eventually slavery was not just beneficial because, you know, black people were inferior. It would be beneficial to white people
Calhoun.
Calhoun had a vision that he wanted basically every voting person to own a slave.
Yeah. And the thing is like
at least one.
Well, I don't know if Calhoun didn't totally get on board with the Fitzhugh argument. I mean, I think they still had most of them did have the racial distinction that was pretty important. And sometimes Fitzhugh did.
I kind of think it was just because it was too unpalatable to embrace because it's the end logic of their critique of Northern labor.
Right. Right.
The
mud sill thesis.
Exactly. It's like these bedraggled wretches that are being cast off by factories and have no, like, that is worse. It's like, well, okay, then what do you do? Like the end of that argument is they should be slaves. They should have guaranteed roof over their head, and they should have food, and they should be like the ward of their employer. Like that is where that would result. That critique of Northern capitalism. What else? What's the other side of it? You know, like what does that critique lead to? It leads to what Fitzhugh said, and I think they didn't like to think about that partly because they were fetishized their racial hierarchy they had in the South,
right?
But also because it's like you're trying to convince people,
it's this ideology of mastery. And ownership, and that in and of itself has a salutary effect on the populace
it's like Bush's ownership society.
Exactly. That Republican order, that in a sense, like, you know, their view of Northern society is that it's falling apart because of, you know, various isms, you know, sort of, you know, fanatical doctrines and class conflict and all of the sort of, you know, riots and class tensions in Northern society are a product of the fact that the working class is dependent on the bourgeois class, but is not protected and sort of nourished by them in the way that, like, you know, a master owns his slave, and that only the South sort of orderly Republican society is guaranteed. You know, slavery is sort of a bedrock of Republican order, and yeah, I mean, you're right. I think that is sort of the implication, Matt. But I don't know. They didn't push it that hard. But whatever.
And the other thing I wanted to say about like the idea that it would have gradually withered away anyway, which is probably true, but I think that the timeline on that is something that people are a little too confident about, I think. Like, and a lot of people like to point to Brazil, right? Because Brazil manumitted in the 1880s, right. And they're like, well, that would have been end point. But it's like, that's in a world where the other big slave power was destroyed.
There's some new research about how Brazilians were really paying close attention to the American Civil War and American Reconstruction and all this stuff, and so the Brazilian slaveholders got smart. The issue is, slavery was preserved in a huge part in the U.S. and it was so strong because of political power. And this is sort of what I'm arguing that. And this was the Republican critique of the slave power, that this system derives intense power, not just because it's, you know, economically dynamic in certain ways, as we sort of have come to appreciate, but because it controls the state. So it controls the rules. It controls the sort of the apparatus, the monopoly of violence, right, in effect, that surrounds the entire United States. And if slaveholders had been deprived of state power, you know, peacefully, there may have been a tug of war for a long time. But they had to, you know, this was the Republican idea that it would sort of gradually whittle away. But who knows how long they would have been deprived of state power? You know, if there hadn't been a civil war, they could have won another election. You know, there were a lot of multiple paths out of this.
Yeah. Okay, I was asked to ask you, because he said Connor said it'd be funny, who are your top five Republicans?
Connor desperately wants me to say Benjamin Wade, who was Marx's favorite Republican, apparently. I'm working on this. I like Henry Wilson. He did flirt with, you guys would like this, he flirted with no-nothingism. He briefly, in Massachusetts, he was a cobbler's son.
So he had no truck with the papists?
Briefly an indentured servant himself.
Oh, snap.
And so he was a sort of, but he was fierce. Who else? Let's see. Josiah Giddings was cool. Salmon P. Chase, though. Salmon Portland Chase is
Cincinnati,
probably.
What?
Yeah, exactly. He was the kind of intellectual guru. And in a sense, the coalition builder of the antebellum Republican Party that, you know, took it from, 2% to state power in a lot of ways. So I think he's probably most respect him, even though I think by all accounts he was like a, you know, intolerable,
he was insufferable.
Pious.
He was prig, really wanted to be president.
Yeah.
But he had an awesome name. Salmon PJs.
Shout out to Galusha Grow, who had a great name and also beat the hell out of a slaveholder on the floor of Congress.
That
William
rules.
Barksdale of Mississippi. And he threw him on the ground.
Oh, wait, the guy who got murked at
Kite. No, or maybe it was
the guy
Kite.
Who got murked at Gettysburg?
It was either Barksdale or Kite. He beat up a slaveholder.
Because Barksdale got murked at Gettysburg.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he died with bravely leading his troops.
Pennsylvania
day.
Was rough on him.
Yeah. Well, fuck that guy. Yeah. Okay, and the other question, who is the biggest dime of the Civil War?
Well, outside of Robert E. Lee?
I mean, you got to go with the Marble Man. You got to go with, I mean, he was etched. Have you seen, I mean, but who else was there? There were some other incredibly good looking Southerners.
I bet if you go through all of those like Ken Burns documentaries or did like copious research on all the photographs that have taken of people like in the Civil War, you will find Dan Quinn in one of those photos. It'll be like 12 Monkeys. It'll be like that scene in 12 Monkeys.
Well, like Dan Quinn is just a title. Like it gets passed down through the ages.
To be honest, it was the Northerners who were sort of, if you want to talk about like early weight training, you know who was really into weights? You know, you can see his weights today if you go to his house in D.C. is Frederick Douglass.
Really?
Like he lift. I mean, he did like lame 19th century, like, you know, kind of like dumbbell.
Yeah,
he
was a super handsome guy,
but
too.
But he was hot.
He was
really,
you know,
hot.
Interesting fact, he was the most photographed man of the 19th
Absolutely,
century, more than Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
He specifically cultivated the what was then still a new technology of photography, portrait photography.
He had
his photo taken all the time.
He had an amazing profile, and all probability
that he liked
had
to have 19th century selfies.
Yeah,
yeah.
So he's the first millennial. Is what you're saying?
The first millennial, and he, you know, based on his dumbbells, he had pretty good delt development. As well, so.
No, dude, his delts looked like fucking bowling balls.
I imagine him going to the beach and kicking sand in William Lloyd Garrison's face. Fucking nerd.
And Charles Sumner, you won't like this as much at all, Felix, but Charles Sumner was really into exercise. He was kind of a big dude himself, which is funny because he's most famous for getting his ass kicked, but he was a huge dude. Preston Brooks was actually afraid, his initial plan was to assault him on the steps of Congress, but he was afraid that he would run up the steps and he was a little smaller than Sumner, and he would be tired, and then Sumner would actually kick his ass. So he jumped him when his like legs were under the desk.
Because he's a piece of shit.
But yeah.
Strategy.
Yeah, exactly.
Strategy.
But Sumner.
And he died of the croup, which is literally what kills babies.
Yeah. But Breitbart.
Fuck Preston Brooks.
Yeah. Sumner. He was famous at Harvard for having like a primitive exercise bike in his like dorm room, basically. So, I mean, cardio, boo.
Well, he was
but,
a bodybuilder.
You know,
he was a bodybuilder.
Something. Yeah.
I mean, he was
that's
a bodybuilder
true, right.
Because he would wake up, do his 30 minutes of cardio to burn fat. And he was big and like used weight training, but he couldn't fight. That's a bodybuilder.
Yeah. Oh. Burn. Pistol shots fired.
We're going to have to do...
Minet balls fired.
We're probably going to have to do a whole nother episode or maybe even video about like 19th century getting swole.
Dude,
yeah. Getting swole
dude,
19th
no.
century style.
No, dude. No. So, dude, listen up. They had the same weight training we have today in Sparta with King Leonidas. He had his bulletproof coffee and his functional strength with kettlebells and battle ropes. And then they were destroyed by the Mongols. And then we didn't have them again until 2005. And in between those times, everyone was retarded and didn't know what they were doing.
Talking about real hardcore history.
For about, my estimation, there was a 4,000-year dark period of exercise.
Of male physique.
Yeah, yeah, but yeah, guys. King Leonidas did have alpha brain. He put butter in his coffee.
Guys in black unitards.
Like, do you just have to watch the movie, like, look at them?
I do wish we'd bring back the round weights.
Yeah,
those the round weights. Yeah, I mean the 19th century guys—they wore too many layers. You know, they had too many.
The
they had
the
cravats. You couldn't. They didn't show any sternum. You know,
they're
it's
prudes.
Not good. Yeah,
King Leonidas, like you saw it, like he went into battle, no shirt, just a skirt, because he had nothing to hide. Like he was like, yo, check me out.
John Quincy Adams did bathe naked in the Potomac. That was something. But
yeah,
no,
but he was like one of those naked old like body positive.
He was like a locker room old.
Yeah.
One of those dudes at the gay pride, one of the old guys at the gay pride parade, just naked with like a little cock ring on, standing around.
All the founding fathers, if they were alive today, they would all be in my gym drying their assholes with a hand dryer. King Leonidas would be showering with me.
Beautiful.
Nothing gay. That's just called Spartan recovery. Nothing weird about that at all. Just two train partners showering together.
Okay. Before we go, I'm glad we need to take a jump in the timeline here. And I just briefly want to bring up with Matt some more gems from the Podesta emails, because I learned about this one through you. You shared this yesterday. This is an absolute gem. It's better than anything we talked about on our earlier in the week show. This is from Lanny Davis, who, if you're not familiar, is like the ultimate Washington, D.C. hagfish. It's just like he's unstoppable, unkillable, no shame. He's just the dude. His hustle never stops.
Money from fucking anybody.
Yeah, no, we were just talking earlier. We were trying to figure out, like, one of his lobbying.
Ivory Coast.
Yeah, one of his.
Equatorial Guinea. Yeah,
like one of his, he did lobbying on behalf of Charles Taylor, right?
Most famously, he was a Zelaya supporter in Honduras. That's kind of when he got on everyone's map, when people were like, when Hillary became Secretary of State, people went like, who is this fucking worm? And that was most people's introduction to the political genius.
Yeah, Lanny Davis.
But Lanny Davis had a big role in the first Clinton administration, wasn't he?
He did,
like,
yeah.
He was like a, you know, somehow legally affiliated with the
White
House.
Yeah, and then in 2008, he was one of that circle of absolute winners who guided the Clinton campaign into the fucking iceberg.
Yeah,
him and Mark Penn, like, eating, you know, like, eating the cold cut tray and like going, wow, we need to micro target NASCAR uncles.
Yeah, no, he's like a he's a Democratic Party remora fish that just will never ever go away. And he shows up, of course, in the Podesta emails because he's positioning himself to get right back into the, you know, White House with, via Hillary Clinton. Here's what he says in an email. He's okay. Facts, facts, facts will defeat Sanders. Maybe win back young people if they came to maybe win back young people if they come to realize the man who claims the word authenticity as his exclusive plays fast and loose with the facts. Here's what he suggests. Robbie, Adrienne, I would like to collect a group of my fellow surrogates and organize a Sanders Truth Squad to flood the three cable news shows from morn to night to challenge Sanders on his non-facts and misleading, quote, free proposals that will substantially raise middle-class taxes or leave millennials with trillions of dollars of debt to pay off for the rest of their
real
lives.
Real Ziegler hours.
Thoughts?
The budget Avengers.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. Like, he's like, hey, you know, don't want to be unrealistic, but probably going to get back all the millennials by going on
Morning Joe.
Neil Cavuto and Morning Joe and talking about the budget deficit. Yeah.
Can I introduce you to a little book called Microeconomics by Gregory Mankiw?
Oh, you're not familiar with the facts. That has never been a persuasive opening to any argument in
but
history.
But the facts are also the facts in this case are also bullshit. Who no one should care about the fucking national debt.
Really
it
doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It used to work really well for like Sean Salisbury when he was on ESPN, like, you know, and they would do like the Coors Light, like cold hard facts. Peyton Manning's gonna have a career year with the Colts this year. Fact. You know, that's the Lanny Davis.
Every American has $50,000 of national debt. Fact. Yeah, you know, you read that, you're like, oh, wow. It really does come down to she's going to be president because she's running against a fucking pussy-grabbing psychopath who has no personal control over anything, any impulse.
You have to give him a little bit of credit, though, that it looks, based on the evidence, like Podesta completely ignored that email, right? Like, there was
comes off, actually. Yeah. I mean, he's obviously a sleazy, you know, DC insider, but he's clearly a smart guy, and he comes to class like he doesn't really have patience for a lot of these hyperventilating dipshits who he has to deal with in his emails.
Do you think Podesta, like, I actually think he might be a mole from somewhere else because he's too smart to work for Hillary. Like, compare everyone else in the email, like, everyone else who's emailing John Podesta is just like, hey, John, I just took 8 Xanaxes. What if I redubbed a video of Bernie Sanders and had him say the N-word? Get back to me.
I don't know if you saw this Podesta email. It was another one I saw this week that was incredibly funny from Neera Tanden, friend of the show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And she was saying to someone in an email, I've always thought the problem of inequality in America was more about people losing access to the middle class than an issue of too many rich people. Continues, blah, 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 blah. Half a paragraph later, she says, you should really read Tomas Piketty on this. It's great. It's like she didn't read that fucking book. No. Well, I didn't read the book either, but I read it, I read enough about it to know that he makes the exact opposite point that it, yeah. it is just.
I mean, it's a heavy book. You could crush a lot of Xanax.
Yeah, no, the point of that book, to my understanding, is that, yes, there are too many rich people. They have all the money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, we need to literally not even tax their incomes. We need to tax their wealth.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, tax their wealth and maybe just export them to the Caribbean after we take all their property.
Yeah.
Some solutions are timeless.
Yeah, let's finish the work of reconstruction in the 21st century. What do you say, fellas?
Yeah. I would love to get a live stream of like a Lloyd Blankfein like trying to like plant turnips, you know, on an island in the Caribbean. That'd be pretty fun to watch.
I'm doing my part by refraining from any sort of human contact with of a sexual nature until I'm 56
Absolutely.
Years old.
Yeah.
56. And when you're 56,
the revolution will be Volsal, folks.
Yeah.
All right. Matt Karp, thanks so much for joining us. The book is This Vast Southern Empire by Early and Often, folks.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Best day of my life.
Cheers. All right. That was Matt Karp. Before we go on our 50th episode, I would just like to say, come episode 100, I plan to be even more powerful than I am now.
I plan to be carried around by suspensors that held up my massive amount of fat due to just the horrific gluttony and indulgence that I'm able to do thanks to the listeners.
No, but and also thanks to Brendan, because honestly, we would not be even... We would still be unlistenable swill.
It would be garbage. It would be ripped. It would be ripped audio from YouTube files with like the cat taking a shit in the background.
I miss the old live broadcast versions, because I think you guys told me that psycho fans would find the feed.
Yes, there were people who would respond on Twitter, like to what the show was before we put it out, and I didn't really at that point. I didn't really understand that was a live. I kind of knew. Maybe theoretically there was a live broadcast, but I had no idea that people could find it and watch it. And yeah, people were like, oh man.
Now it's just the tankies like, who do that.
Now, yes.
When they
they're in the room now.
Yeah. We're being bugged and it's being uploaded to their Reddit.
Zone.
Yeah.
Keep them coming, folks. Like I said, episode 50, and we're going to blink our eyes and it's going to be episode 100. Mm-hmm. And you know, like I said, I feel like gold. Before we go, just a little bit of housekeeping. We've got not one, but two Chapo live events coming up very soon. First of which is Wednesday of this week, the third and final debate. We're going to be at Caroline's with Virgil Texas to complete the trilogy. Then, election night, November 8th, we're coming to you again from Genius HQ in Gowanus, and again with Virgil Texas. It's going to be a Chapo live show for election night, but also an election night party.
Hell yeah.
Like we're going to rein in the new apocalypse. Yes. We're going to be with you till we have a new Reich Chancellor.
Death to Dangerous Donald. Long live the new flesh.
Till then, bye guys.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Yeah, just kick things off. Maybe we could just talk very briefly about who we are. I am Will Menaker. You know me as Will Menaker from Twitter. But just tell you a little about myself. I love coffee, dogs, big time movie guy, and I'm really into neo-feudalism and amateur phrenology, blood, soil, and tradition.
My name is Vernuth Friedman, @BioLogic, Vernuth, Keurig, not Tassimo. If you Tassimo, unfollow. Babes are pejorative. Lists are to keep track of my favorites. Retweets are not endorsement, and my son is dead.
My name's Matt Crisman, @KushBomb. I'm sort of the Midwest correspondent to talk to sort of the rootless cosmopolitan New Yorkers on the team. And the only thing I love more than a hot sizzling plate of bacon is proving people wrong by their own
their own logic. Did we lose Matt?
Matt was chiving too hard, and his broadband went out.